hands on their thin, knobby shoulders. You'll be safe here. This is Rainy Lane. She helps run the foster center.
Where they'll split us up, Sarah hissed, pulling away from me.
Rainy spoke swiftly. We never separate siblings. If we're unable to find a good home for the four of you, you may stay in the center as long as you like. That was one of the things I'd been counting on when I brought Rainy the first of the abandoned children I discovered, half dead in the streets. Her adopted daughters were biological sisters, Alina and Michaela Lane. Family was everything to her. Still, it wouldn't be long before the recently formed center became too full to continue offering such an alternative. Sarah Brady squinted up at Rainy through damp, tangled hair, hostility blazing in her eyes. Silently, I applauded her bravado. The terrified 11-year-old had managed to take care of her infant sister and her younger siblings for nearly 2 months, without the many she-seer gifts I'd had at her age. She was a fighter. But she was an 80-pound, dripping-wet fighter, and Dublin, AWC, was no city for lightweights. "You know who I am and what I do," I said to Sarah softly. "Have you heard such terrible things about me, then? Or the foster center?"
"I've not heard of your foster center at all," she said stiffly. "But kids on the telly always get split up."
"And dreadful things happen to them," the shadows in her eyes said.
"What about me?" I said. "What about you?" Sarah said with a dismissive sniff.
I smiled faintly. She knew who I was. I was a legend. My talents, coupled with the infrequent appearance of Shazam, had seemed that.
"You're some kind of superhero," the boy exclaimed. "And your sword?"
He gestured to it where it was sheathed across my back.
"Crashes like lightning when you fight, and you have a great fat cat with superpowers."
I winked at Thomas.
"Never call him fat. It makes him grumpy. Nor is he, quite a cat. Well, he was a hell cat, but that was an entirely different thing." "There's no such thing as superheroes," Sarah scoffed. "And if you are one, why didn't you stop the fairy?"
She clamped her mouth shut. These weren't the first children I'd found who believed the Fae had stolen their parents. It made no sense. Fae didn't abduct adults. They lured them off with glamour, illusion and lies. "Where else will you sleep tonight? They firebombed your squat and burned you out," I reminded. "For no reason. In a moment of boredom. A diversion for the three bullies who'd done it. They'd laughed as the children fled the blazing shell, screaming. Sent three half-starved kids and a helpless baby out into the deadly night. I'd been torn between going after the kids or the bastards who'd tossed the bombs. I'd gone for the kids. First." Sarah fisted her hands at her sides.
"It wasn't fair. I found that house. No one else was living there. I watched it for 5 days before we took it, and they burnt it. A perfectly good place to live. They didn't even want it. Why would anyone do that?"
A house with running water and electricity. A thing she'd needed desperately to keep her family alive. But possession was 9/10 of the law only if one was strong enough to enforce that law, and her ragged troop wasn't. During the day, Dublin AWC was a normal, bustling, safe city, if there was such a thing, with the walls down between Fae and mortals, 2/3 of the world population gone, fragments of Fairy drifting free, light court Fae living openly in town, establishing cult-like settlements around the country, and gangs warring to control supply and demand. At night, all bets were off. The predators came out to play, and if you weren't one of them, you were meat. There were only 3 types of beings that dared trespass beyond the protected Temple Bar district after dark. The very powerful, the very foolish, or the helpless, driven there by one threat or another.
"Just stay here with me for the night," Rainy said gently. "See how you feel in the morning. No one will force you to remain with us. May I see the baby, Sarah?"
She extended her arms. I believe we've a diaper that needs changing.
Sarah shot a quick glance over her shoulder and sniffed, then glared up at Rainey.
I suppose you've no diapers?
Rainey went on in a low, soothing tone.
No food or change of clothing? We've plenty of that here.
Of course Sarah had nothing, I thought with a rush of bitterness and relief. She hadn't been on the streets long enough to realize a child on her own needed many, many places to hide. All that she'd managed to beg, borrow, or steal was stashed in the house that was taken from her. It was time for tough love. I said, Do you want your baby sister to get diaper rash or catch cold from the weather? How will you get medicine if one of you gets sick? You might be able to survive out there, Sarah, but the others won't. What if something happens to you? What will your sisters and brother do then? You're responsible for them. You have to be strong enough for four. Now isn't the time to be short-sighted and selfish.
Sarah flinched and cried.
I'm not selfish. Fear, isolation, crushing responsibility, she woke up to it, lived it all day, and fell asleep with it. A too heavy stone in her too empty stomach. I wanted to hug her, take her in my arms and promise her life would be good again. Not selfish at all. Selflessly doing everything she could. But I needed to get her inside the door of the townhouse. There were three bastards skulking around out there, preying on the innocent, with my sights on their backs. I knew what she was thinking. Freedom conferred a certain solace. When it's only you taking care of your world, you feel as if you have some control over the many things that might go wrong. When you widen your circle to trust others, the risk increases exponentially. As if she'd just ended an inner debate on the same thought, Sarah Brady tensed, rising onto the balls of her feet again, trembling but determined. I shot Rainey a look that said, She's going to bolt. On cue, Rainey pushed the door to the townhome open all the way, allowing the scent of baking bread and a slowly simmering stew to waft out. I watched Sarah carefully. I'd had to drag a few kids inside, kicking and screaming, and had no problem doing so now. But more often than not, what words failed to accomplish, the promise of a hot meal did. It was easier for them in the long run if they took the first step willingly.
Sarah, I'm hungry, the younger girl cried plaintively. I'm thirsty, and I need to pee. Just tonight, okay?
Can we, oh, Sarah, please? Thomas chimed in. I'm cold.
Sarah looked from my eyes to Rainey's and back again. Few adults probed gazes with such intensity, but the fate of her entire family was in her 11-year-old hands. I wanted to tell her how proud I was of her, that she impressed me with all she'd done to keep them alive and together, but Rainey would say all that and more.
Okay, Sarah Brady said tightly. But just for tonight. One night, she repeated, glaring at her siblings.
Once my charges were tucked safely inside and the door was closed, I smiled as I melted into the night. That was what they all said at first, then found their fears were no match for the breadth and scope of Rainey Lane's heart. Seeing Mac's mom was always uncomfortable for me, given the unspoken that lay between us. She'd never been anything but welcoming and kind. It was why I'd chosen to bring the first of the children to her and her husband Jack that bloody night months ago, and why I would continue bringing them, assured she would always grant them safe haven. Anyone that would welcome someone like me could never turn away a child. I tracked my prey into Temple Bar and out across the River Liffey and back again. Debating whether the trio was so powerful, so drunk or drugged, or just so bloody stupid, that they brazenly walked the killing fields of our city. Their deaths would save countless lives. Still, my sword hand itched so much for not being allowed to use it to kill the Fae now that Mac was queen, I'd begun to question my sentencing methods. I'd been taught a taste for the kill at a young age. Patterns like that are hard to break. I was good at it, and someone had to do it. Then Dancer died, and the finality of death took on new meaning for me. I still haven't found mercy, with the exception of kids and animals, but I've discovered creative sentencing. I had a few choice fragments of fairy, IFPs, Mac used to call them, I'd begun using for prisons. Speaking of my sword hand, it really was itching. And scratching it through my fingerless glove wasn't working, so I peeled it off. My palm was black and cold as ice. The last time I'd seen it this bad was years ago, standing in a cemetery, watching shadows explode from the graves. Shadows I'd been hunting for the past 2 years with no success. No one else had seen them that night, and no one had seen them since. I watched as the darkness spread, creeping around to the back of my hand, then shooting up into my fingers. A sudden sharp pain stabbed beneath all my nails. Black veins exploded up my wrist, vanishing into the sleeve of my jacket. I stripped off my coat. Inky veins and black streaks marbled my left arm, nearly to the shoulder. I was 14 when I stabbed a hunter through the heart with the Fey Hollow, the Sword of Light. The giant winged beast gushed black blood and shot me an incomprehensible look before closing fiery eyes. I thought I killed it. But when I returned to snap photos for my newspaper, the enormous dragon-like creature was gone. My hand turned to dark ice within the hour, making me worry something of the creature had seeped up my sword and infected me. I was enormously relieved when my hand regained its normal color and temperature a few days later. I'd since discovered spells work better when etched with that hand, and if, occasionally, I woke in the middle of the night to find it dark and freezing, I considered it a static oddity. It was no longer static. Something had changed. I waited to see if the darkness under my skin would continue to spread. When it didn't, I put my glove on and shrugged back into my jacket. There was nothing I could do about it. I couldn't unstab the hunter. I'd think about it later. My hunt took me in the direction of Baron's Books and Baubles. I liked seeing the lovely, spatially challenged bookstore that was sometimes 4 floors, sometimes 6, slicing the night, bastion eternal, spotlights blazing on the rooftop. It was a promise made of timeless stone, polished wood, wrought iron, and stained glass. One day, Mac and Barons would come back. One day, I'd bang in that door again. One day, the people who mattered to me would return. Through the many disasters and riots that had befallen our city, even the Ice Age of the Hoarfrost King, Baron's Books and Baubles had remained untouched. I wouldn't be surprised to learn it had stood there since the dawn of time. There's a special feeling about the spot, as if once, a very long time ago, something terrible nearly happened at this precise longitude and latitude, and someone, or thing, dropped the bookstore on the gash to keep the possibility from ever occurring again. As long as the walls stand and the place is intact, we'll be okay. Some people have churches. I have BB&B. I turned a corner, anticipating the familiar sight, the rush of warm memories. The bookstore wasn't there. I narrowed my eyes, blinked, and looked again. Still not there. I scowled down damp, fog-wisped blocks at an empty concrete lot. Then I kicked up into the slipstream and devoured the distance, stopping shy of where the front wall of the bookstore should be. If the building was concealed with glamour, I had no intention of crashing into it. I sported fewer bruises these days and liked it that way. Beyond the empty lot, Jericho Barons' epic garage was gone too. In its place was another empty concrete-surfaced lot. My stomach clenched. I reached out and felt around. No wall. I took a few steps and groped blindly about again. I strode forward until I was standing dead center in the rear seating area of the bookstore. Mac's fireplace should have been to my right. The Chesterfield behind me. There was nothing. I got a sudden chill. Nothing wasn't quite the right word. The bookstore was gone. but a thick, gluey residue lingered, as if something cataclysmic had transpired here, leaving a miasma of emotional, temporal, or spatial distortion in its place. Perhaps all three. "This is bullshit," I growled. I'd had it. Enough was enough. Chester's nightclub at 939 Revimal Street had gone dark 2 years, 1 month, 4 days, and 17 hours ago. Not that I was keeping track or anything. The Fay-run club Illyrium on Renault Avenue had taken its place. The nine were gone, and the last I'd heard, Christian was somewhere in Scotland, holed up in an ancient crumbling castle, shades of Unseelie King, anyone? With powerful wards placed at a 75-mile perimeter around him to keep everyone out. Or him in. No one seemed sure. Now someone, or something, had taken my bookstore. The universe continued erasing the best parts of my life. Squaring my shoulders, I stalked to the empty lot where the garage should have been and studied the concrete, looking for wards, spells, any hint of illusion or glamour. Nothing. Both buildings were simply gone. As was my promise. I knew nothing about what was going on with Mac, and had no way of contacting her. Had she established control over the Fae Court? Taken them away and tidied up after herself? The bookstore was a site of immense power that she and Barons would never leave lying around for someone else to exploit or claim. Feeling oddly lost without my Mecca. Dublin just wasn't Dublin without BB&B. I spun away and was nearly back to the street when I felt a rumble beneath my feet. Paused and cocked my head, listening intently. There it was again. Faintly. So faintly, I'd almost missed it, even with my superb hearing. The baying of an animal. A wounded animal from the sound of it. Badly wounded. Not a wolf. Something... Fae? Terrible sound. Pain. So much pain.
I'll never let you be lost again.
Out of the blue, Riordan's voice exploded in my head, deep and faintly mocking. I had no idea how that memory escaped incarceration from the high-security ward of my disciplined brain. All my that-man memories were under strict house arrest, locked down tight. I didn't think about Riordan anymore. There'd been a time the sheer number of superheroes in Dublin had annoyed me. Now I was a wolf without a pack. There'd been a time everyone had wanted me to open up, let them in. I'd complied. A word I can barely think inside my head, even when it's the right thing to do, without hackles sprouting like poison ivy all over my body. And what did they do? Left. I was feeling as volatile as my Hellcat, but the bookstore's disappearance was the last straw. It began to rain, further dampening my mood. Rain is just what Ireland does. You'd think I'd be used to it. I hold a deep personal grudge against rain. It makes my hair go curly and wild, completely undermining the cool, composed look I like to project to the world. Breathing deep, I kicked up into the slipstream where I could avoid the raindrops. Unless animals began attacking Dublin, whatever was baying wasn't my problem. It sounded like it was dying anyway. And if such an attack did come, I knew one very hungry Hellcat that would relish the job. I turned my focus back to what I excelled at. The hunt. Dublin, or Dublin, the Black Pool, with its many colourful inhabitants, was my city now, more so than it had ever been, given every bloody damned one of my fellow warriors had bloody well decamped. I would protect it. I lost my prey at the mirror, or rather, I let them go. Unwilling to leap blindly into a silver with an unknown destination. I'd been closing in fast when the three men ducked into the entrance of an abandoned, crumbling brewery on the north bank of the River Liffey. I'd shadowed them through the gloomy industrial interior and was about to ease up into the slipstream to nab them when they abruptly vanished into a wall. I approached with caution. When the song of making was sung, repairing the fabric of our world, I'd thought reality would return to a semblance of normal. The Fae-induced changes to our planet would reverse. The Light Court would retreat to their own realm, despite the lack of a wall between our worlds, and society would resume its usual bleating, morally ambiguous course. In retrospect, I don't know why I thought any of those things. Perhaps I just wanted a happy ending. None of it happened. Post-song reality was one in which the rules only became clear by interacting with them, often with unpleasant consequences. Children were being born with unusual gifts, although I'd call some of them curses. Objects didn't always function quite like one had every rational reason to expect. Doors didn't consistently go where you thought they would, and mirrors were the most unreliable of all, even human ones. Magic burned in the planet, more potent than ever, as if the ancient melody had penetrated deep into the earth, crooning in dangerously random fashion, "Awaken." Everything had gotten more juice. Even us she-seers. The many new elements of unpredictability had changed my behavior. I traveled in the slipstream only for short distances now, under calculated circumstances. There was too much I needed to see, less I could take for granted, and I absorbed few details moving in a higher dimension. I skirted a large vat to get a closer look at the silver. Embedded in stained and crumbling brick, a narrow black opening rippled in the wall, 3 inches from the floor, stretching all the way up to the decaying rafters. Something about the slender, dark aperture made my blood run a little colder. A gust of stifling air belched from the shivering surface, reeking of wood smoke, and I cocked my head, sniffing. Old copper? Perhaps blood? Distantly, I heard a rhythmic chant, thousands of voices, perhaps tens of thousands, repeating something over and over in a nearly hypnotic cadence. It wasn't English. I didn't recognize the language. I eased warily closer, kicking through several inches of litter and broken bottles, sending a small horde of roaches skittering into shadowy corners of the room. All mirrors debut on my dangerous list. Few of them work their way off it. I wasn't even willing to put one in my bathroom until it underwent rigorous testing. A person with normal hearing would have heard nothing coming from the dark glass. But I'm not normal. I catch the gentle whoosh of air displacement as people move. If I lay my ear to the earth, I hear countless insects wriggling and tunneling in the top layer of soil. I still couldn't decipher the words, but the indistinct chant was now threaded by thin, distant, blood-curdling screams. I narrowed my eyes, focusing my she-seer gifts on the inky darkness, as if I might penetrate the veil. Still, I saw nothing but a narrow stream of roaches, climbing the few inches of wall and vanishing into the glass. Too bad I didn't have one of Dancer's handy little wireless cameras to attach to one. See if I could get a glimpse at the other side. I wondered if they were normal earth roaches, or part of the disgusting papa roach that used to hang at Chester's. Unfortunately, they're indistinguishable to me. I backpedaled from the wall and squirted up into the slipstream a half second before the mirror exploded, spraying razor-sharp splinters of dark glass across the floor. I'd felt it coming. A vibration on the other side, as if the blow of whatever implement or spell had struck it, required a second or more to reach my side of the portal. By the time I dropped down again and crunched across broken glass and still more roaches, the wall was just a wall. Access to my prey gone. It changed nothing. 4 children had been driven into the streets to their certain death, for amusement. There aren't many things I hold sacred. Kids are one of them. I never forget. Never stop until I finish my job. The men's faces were etched into my memory. Their time would come. I stalked through the brewery, restless, unsatisfied. It was nearly dawn. That liminal time when night became day, villains vanished, and vengeance got shelved. I spend my day doing normal things like laundry, cleaning, checking in at the orphanage, modifying and monitoring my many obligations, dropping by the Abbey to train initiates and catch some time to read the latest translations.
I derive a great deal of satisfaction from doing my part to make our world safer. Tonight I'd failed, and it would be 12 long hours before I got to try again. As dangerous as night in Dublin was, day ran fairly smoothly, as if darkness and light had struck a compact of their own, apportioning order to the day and chaos to the night. I like the nights better. Carpe noctem, not diem. My days drag. Nights when I feel most alive. I banged out the door and exploded into the wet, foggy morning, tucking my head against a hard drizzle. As I was about to kick up into the slipstream, a sudden movement from above caught my attention. I paused and glanced up to watch something roughly the size of a playing card falling from the sky, end over end. I have a theory about people. Actually, I have a lot of theories about people, but this particular one goes, if someone throws something at you, you're either a catcher or a ducker. I've never been a ducker. I've learned the hard way that it's sometimes wiser to be. Still, instincts being instinctual and all, I jumped and caught the object while it was a few feet above my head. Ow! I exclaimed. The edges were sharp and cut the tips of my fingers as they closed around it. Cursing softly, I wiped the blood on my jeans before turning my attention to the card. 4 inches by 3, about a quarter of an inch thick, it was fashioned of alternating strands of green and black metals, woven together in an intricate, repeating Celtic knot pattern. It was beautiful. I'm Irish to the bone and proud of it. I love my country, my heritage, the fierce resilience and pride of the Irish people. This was fine work, done in the old way. Lovely but slightly rough, as if smelt and beaten by a blacksmith. I had no idea what it was, or why it had fallen from the sky. Shrugging it yet another mystery, I turned the metal piece over. What do you want? Was chiseled into the metal in light green letters. A dozen instant responses took vague shape in my mind. Seriously, it was a bloody long list. I rolled my eyes and was about to toss it in the gutter when I saw something shimmering at the border and retracted my hand to inspect the card more closely. I dropped it, as if burned. A spell was etched into the metal, nearly undetectable in slightly darker shades of green on green around the perimeter. A person with normal vision would never have seen it. Years ago, I'd have instantly blamed Riordan for any spelled thing I found. But he was gone, and in our new magic-enhanced world, the possibilities were vast. Another she-seer, Enyo, had told me just last week that some of the Fae lording over cult-like encampments in the rural areas were believed by many to not be Fae at all. None of her wary sources had been willing to elaborate on what they really were, but they'd insisted the charismatic, powerful beings hadn't descended from the true race, and that those of us at the Abbey should give them wide berth. Which, of course, only made me want to go exploring. I stared down at the metal card on the pavement. What was its purpose? What did the spell do? I shivered, grateful I hadn't muttered a wish aloud. I like wards. They're practical, straightforward, and don't usually bite you in the ass when you use them. Spells, on the other hand, are convoluted, dangerous, and unpredictable things, especially when blood's involved. I glanced down at my fingertips, then back at the card. My blood was smeared along the top edge. Bloody hell. I wasn't picking it up again, on the off chance I hadn't already activated whatever the spell was meant to do. I'd learned more than I ever wanted to know about blood spells from the monstrous Rowena. There was no way I was giving it a second shot at me. Nor was I willing to leave it lying around for someone else to cut themselves on. I towed the thing into a nearby gutter, watched until it vanished down the drain, disappearing into the vast, watery tunnels and caverns of Dublin below, then kicked up into the slipstream and headed home. 4. And Shazzy's Got Stormy Eyes. Shazam,
What is going on here? I wrinkled my nose as I stepped into my bedroom, peering through the gloom. The dark room smelled funny, like a zoo. Fecund. I've always liked that word. Just not in my room. The glow of Dancer's stereo cast enough light so I could see Shazam had either doubled in width or there was something next to him on my fluffy, freshly laundered cloud of a white comforter. Coupled with the strong animal odor, it could only mean one thing. You know the rules. No eating in bed, I rebuked. No blood, no guts, no gristle in my sheets. I didn't think that was too much to ask.
I'm not eating. That's all you think I do. I do other things, too,
came the derisive sniff from the darkness. My eyes fully adjusted now. I could clearly see the outline of a carcass lying next to him, furred and lifeless. Like what? Saving leftovers for later? I slid my sword off over my shoulder, propped it against the wall, and unzipped my jacket. He said smugly,
I have a mate.
Holy hell. I froze, half out of my jacket. Thoughts collided in my brain too fast to process, leaving a single, horrid image. Sharing a bed with a mating hellcat. I'd take blood, guts, and gristle any day. I flipped on the light and nearly burst out laughing. But I'm not foolish enough to laugh at a hellcat who might be mating. Shazam was sprawled on the comforter, one massive, tufted paw clamped tightly around the neck of an utterly terrified, exhausted creature, keeping it pinned to the bed. It was no wonder I'd thought it was dead. Stretched on its side, it was barely breathing. Round, golden eyes wide and fixed on nothing. There was froth on its muzzle and whiskers. Good grief! Shazam had brought home a palace cat.
This is Onome,
he informed me proudly. I shook my head, not certain where to begin with this latest escapade of his. He certainly kept things interesting. Shazam, you're a sentient, talking, highly evolved being. That, I stabbed my finger at it, is a cat, and barely a quarter your size. Let the poor baby go. She looked traumatized, deeply.
You're not the boss of me.
Am too, I reminded. You agreed to that. Where did you find her? Have you considered that she may already have a mate, a family of her own? He smirked.
Brought them too, Tiny Red.
I dropped my jacket to the floor, guns and knives forgotten, and glanced hastily around, realizing I should have seen this coming. Shazam had been obsessing over wildlife DVDs for the past few months, looking for new game to spice up his nightly hunt, I'd thought. But he'd been searching for a girlfriend. Solitary creatures that lived in grasslands and steppes, palace cats were the size of a domestic cat, with stocky bodies, shaggy, dense fur, stripes and ringed tails. I wrinkled my nose again. They were also known for scent marking their territory, which explained the foul odor in my bedroom. How many and where? He shrugged nonchalantly.
Don't know, don't care. They aren't Onome.
I dropped to the floor and peered beneath my bed. A dozen yellow eyes glared out at me from fluffy faces, regarding me with identical expressions of hostility. Low-set ears flattened to their heads. A single side of their mouth drawn up in an Elvis-like sneer. Sometimes I feel like I live in a cartoon. There were six palace cats from the far reaches of Asia sneering at me from beneath my bed. As they began to growl, I bit back another laugh. Once I began laughing, I would either hurt Shazam's feelings or lose what little respect I managed to command with him at times like these. And said firmly, Shazam, you will return all of them to wherever you found them.
Will not.
I poked my head up and glared at him. Will, too.
Can't make me,
he said airily. Technically, that was true. Handling Shazam took patience and tact. I pushed myself up from the floor. When did it, on a May, eat last?
She will eat after we mate,
he said grandly. Does it really look like she's about to jump up and mate with you anytime soon?
She's gathering her strength.
She's scared out of her wits. My first goal was to get the small, terrified cat away from him. She needs food and water. Earth animals can't go as long as you without eating. Let her go, and I'll get some food for... I glanced under the bed at my sneering, growling companions and sighed. Our guests. Shazam had been in Dublin with me for over 2 years, and I knew it had been a big adjustment for him. I'd found him on a planet in the Silvers, living in another dimension, half mad from long solitude. He was the only one of his species left, and I could only imagine how lonely that must be. Perhaps he should have a mate. Perhaps the palace cat might grow to like him. Who was I to say he shouldn't have a family of his own? Could he have a family of his own with an earth animal? Did palace cats have large litters? What the bloody hell would I do with half a dozen palace/hell cats? My brain thinks in Batman quips under pressure, a defense mechanism that keeps my chin up while the world goes to hell around me. This time, it married an old Star Trek episode to my favorite comic book hero and pronounced, "Holy tribbles, Batman, we've got trouble." Swallowing my mirth, I demanded, "Can you have babies?" He gave me a strange look.
"Children? Of course."
"Is that what this is about? Do you want to make them with her?" Violet eyes gleaming, he chuffed with amusement.
"That is not how children are made. One day you will know how children are made."
I raised my brows. I'd figured out how children were made when I was 5 years old, sitting unsupervised in front of a TV all day with a remote control. I wasn't sure I wanted to hear how he thought children were made. If she doesn't eat, she may die, assuming she didn't expire from shock first. I'll be back with food and water. As I turned toward the door, I shot a withering look over my shoulder. I mean it. Let her go. She's terrified of you. He sniffed.
Riveted by my prowess.
Catatonic with shock.
Overcome by my magnificence.
This could go on all night. Pinned by your paw, I said dryly. If you're so certain of yourself, try removing it and see what happens.
She will remain in my thrall,
he said confidently. I shut the bedroom door as I left. The last thing I needed was a horde of hostile palace cats coming after me, attacking my ankles. I could imagine too many ways things could get even weirder than they already were. I had 7 palace cats in my bedroom. It wasn't the first time Shazam had brought something unusual home with him, but none of those things had ever been alive and required sustenance. Although I stock fresh meat and blood for Shazam, there was no way I was taking bowls of it into my clean, cream-carpeted bedroom, which already sported an odor challenging enough to eradicate. No doubt I'd be tearing the damned carpet out. Or moving again. My eating habits have changed over the years. Unlike most people, I have little to no emotional attachment to food. I see it as necessary energy and prioritize it in that order. Fat first, protein next, carbs last. I need it fast and efficient, so I stock my various residences with canned tuna, canned coconut milk, chocolate bars, and high-carb snacks. I glanced at the closed door of my bedroom down the hallway and finally let my laughter bubble free as I grabbed bowls and began opening cans of tuna. 25 minutes later, the palace cats had devoured 19 cans of tuna and nearly a gallon of water. They were going to need to pee and do other bad-smelling things. not that I believed the odor in my bedroom could get much worse. I spend my nights in the dirtiest parts of the city. I like to spend my days in tidy surroundings. I was stretched back against the tufted velvet headboard of my bed, legs crossed. Shazam was sitting on the dresser, alternating between peering beneath the bed at his mate and her family and giving me the evil eye. I waited in silence. He tended to come around to my viewpoint more quickly if I gave him time to work things through himself, offering the occasional gentle nudge.
I did nothing wrong,
he said finally, sourly.
I get bored when you're gone.
So come with me. You used to all the time.
I miss something, Yi-Yi,
he said plaintively. Oh, my friend, so do I. Many things, I said softly. What?
Something,
he said, his eyes filling with tears.
I don't know.
Beneath the bed, I heard claws scratching the carpet as it was prepared for use as a litter box. If you return them, Shazam, we'll figure this out. I don't want you to be lonely. If it's a mate you want, we'll find one. But you can't abduct a wild animal and her family and decide she's going to be yours. You have to move slowly. Give her time to get to know you. And it has to go both ways or it's ownership. Living things aren't property. You can't take them simply because you want them. It was my job to teach my bombastic, powerful friend how to live among us, and I took it seriously. I didn't cite the rules and expect him to obey. I tried to help him understand why the rules mattered. He slumped in a puddle of depression.
She can't talk, and she hardly even thinks. She doesn't know the world is bigger than her cage or this room. She's never seen the stars and hunted on wild planets. I'm not what terrifies her. Everything terrifies her.
His head drooped to the top of the dresser, and he put his paws over his eyes. She's not your equal, and never can be, I said, vocalizing what was bothering him. He said wearily,
She is not.
I smiled wryly. Over the past few years, I'd done what passed as dating for someone like me. Each time I tried, I ended up feeling more alone, not less. Fascination isn't love, and pedestals are hard, uncomfortable, and only big enough for one. Some people get a home with family and friends. Some people get a pedestal. Perversely, those on the pedestal hunger for the normalcy of a home and family, while those with a home and family hunger for the glamour and excitement of a pedestal. Further compounding things, the magic of the song enhanced my Shisir gifts. I'm physically stronger and have to hold back all the time. Careful, restrained sex is an oxymoron in my book. I get more release from exploding a few of Raiden's punching bags. Will you return her then? All of them? I added. Precision was a must with my moody beast.
Yes, Yi-Yi,
he said with a gusty sigh. After a moment, he lifted his head from the dresser. His violet eyes narrowed and shot a meaningful glance at my left hand, which was still cold and black.
It's happening again.
I know.
Bigger now. It doesn't hurt?
He fretted. No, I'm fine. He assessed me intently, as if seeking reassurance of that. Then his body disappeared and only his head remained, his large, expressive eyes gleaming with love. I smiled. I see you too, Shazam. His disembodied head nodded regally.
I will return after I've hunted Yi-Yi.
Then all of him was gone. I dropped to the floor, peered beneath my bed, and watched with relief as the palace cats popped out of existence, one by one. I stood beneath the spray of a long hot shower while he was gone, washing my hair, shaving my legs, and considering my left hand. The stain had retreated to beneath the crook of my elbow.
Although my hand was still black, even the nails, my fingers were no longer quite so cold. I had no idea why it happened, or what caused it, if anything. It was possible it was simply random. Sometimes, when my hand turned black, I was in the midst of a dangerous situation. Other times, I could tie it to nothing threatening in my vicinity. Each time it happened, I felt oddly shaky afterward, and had found eating helped allay the strange enervation. I flexed my hand beneath the warm spray. It didn't hurt. Well, aside from the brief stabbing pain I'd felt earlier when it shot up beneath my nails, the wraiths in the cemetery had been repelled by it. What had the hunter done to me that night so long ago? I hadn't seen any of the enormous winged beasts in our skies for years, and I'd been watching, waiting. I had questions. I'd found no reference to the hunters in the Abbey's vast libraries, but then I still had the lion's share of the collections to wade through. It was slow going, sorting through the bits and pieces of my she-seer heritage. I read for hours a day, sitting with those at the Abbey who were scanning the ancient fragile scrolls and books to create an electronic library with cross-referencing tags that will never decompose. It should have been done long ago, but the prior headmistress of our order had been more inclined to let our secrets rot than share them. I turned off the water, wrapped a towel around my body, and used a second one on my hair. As I toweled it dry and sorted through the damp tangle of long red curls, I turned my thoughts back to the problem of Shazam. He'd been different lately, with fewer moments of lucid brilliance and more of emotional angst. I was worried about him. When he got back, we were going to have a long talk, and I wasn't going anywhere until I figured out what to do to snap him out of his funk. If an emergency came up, he was going with me to take care of it. I should never have let him stay at home while I'd gone out patrolling the past few months. After nearly 7 years together, I knew being alone and unseen, as he'd been in Olean, was the worst thing for him. I smoothed a light oil on my hair to keep it from going completely wild, grabbed my clothes off the counter, tugged on a pair of faded, ripped jeans and one of Dancer's old faded t-shirts, a white one with, "Holy shift, look at the asymptote on that mother function," emblazoned on the front. Wearing his clothes made me feel like a part of him was here with me, although I wasn't sure he'd be particularly impressed with my life. Lately, it positively brimmed with routine. Epic adventures were a thing of the past, fey battles forbidden. Sighing, I retrieved the sword that I wasn't allowed to use for its universe-given purpose from its perch within reach of the shower. I love my sword. I pet it. It soothes me. Cold, hard, frequently bloody, we're two of a kind. Made for war. But with a bit of work, we shine right back up again. Double-edged, the straight blade swells in thickness and width as it nears the guard. The blade, apart from the hilt, is 34.5 inches long. Most of the time. In battle, I've seen that length increase and decrease. Dancer was never able to identify what it's made from, but it's oddly light, yet weighty at the same time. Razor sharp, and has proved unbreakable. Although the blade shimmers alabaster, the grip is fashioned from engraved lengths of ebony and ivory metals woven together. The guard is dark as midnight, and resembles narrow wings that arc back toward my hand. The heavily engraved pommel is formed from the same obsidian metal as the guard, and is always cold. Ornate, dark symbols, a cipher that has never ceased to stump me despite the considerable time I've wasted over the years with pen and paper trying to work it out, flow the length of the blade on both sides. The symbols often move, swirling too rapidly for me to transcribe. When I fight, my sword burns incandescent, and I often find those undecipherable symbols seared into the flesh of our victims. Most of all, it feels good in my hand, as if it was made just for me. And one day, I just know deep in my bones, I'll get to use it again. I padded out into the bedroom. My fingers tightened on the hilt. there was a man sitting on my bed. Not Fay. But considering he'd breached my many booby traps to gain entrance, there was no way he was human, either.
5. I put a spell on you.
By Loki's balls,
the man said, shaking his head.
You're not at all what I expected.
Expectations limit your ability to perceive things. I try to have few. I leaned against the door jamb, assessing him, sword deceptively at ease at my side. He scanned me back, absorbing the bare feet, the holes in the knees of my jeans, the face void of makeup, the tumble of wet hair. His gaze hitched briefly on my left hand, and his eyes flared infinitesimally, then narrowed.
But you're a mere child. How did something like you get your hands on the fairy sword?
On February 20th of this year, my last birthday, I'd decided to commit to an age. As I was somewhere between 21 and 23, I split the difference and settled on 22. Casual and without makeup, I knew I looked several years younger. It worked for me. Strangers often underestimated me. I shrugged and said nothing.
Well, hand it over and let's be done with it,
he said, pushing up from the bed, hand outstretched, eyes fixed possessively on the softly glowing blade at my side.
Time is short. I've much to do.
I laughed in spite of myself. He was shorter than me, with a lean build, wearing black jeans, boots, and a green shirt. Wavy raven hair swept back from the high forehead above a narrow face. His eyes were nearly as emerald as mine, with tiny amber flecks and alight with amusement. I was the one holding the sword. As far as I could tell, he wasn't carrying a single weapon. I don't think so.
We made a deal. You will honor it.
I made no deal with you. He spanned the distance between us in a sprightly leap, smiling broadly.
Oh, but you did.
He caught my hand in his and lifted it to his lips, kissed it, then held it between us and glanced meaningfully at the cuts across my fingertips. Right. He was wearing black and green, like his calling card. His hair was black, and his eyes were green. What was with people? Wasn't anyone normal anymore? Was having a colour theme the new trend? That was a cheat, I said irritably. You made the edges razor sharp and flung it at me. He cooed brightly.
And you caught it? There will be no welshing. You plucked it from the sky, offered me your blood, and made a wish. I granted it. You owe me.
I didn't make a wish, and you didn't grant anything. And I didn't offer you my blood. You took it. Through deceit. Green eyes danced with mischief.
I just love that part, don't you? Blood is blood, no matter how you obtain it.
His gaze shifted, swirling with menace and mockery. That's a trap. You can't sucker people into spells. He clasped his hands together beneath his chin and sneered.
Oh, please. As if your history isn't positively mired in tales of stupid humans lured into unsavory deals and contracts and their repercussions.
He snapped his fingers sharply beneath my nose.
Wake up, child! Pay attention! Fools fall! It's what they do!
I growled. I'm neither a child nor a fool.
By my standards, you're both. You didn't have to catch it. I presented an opportunity. You took it. Pay up. The sword is mine.
I said coolly, I didn't make a wish, and you didn't grant one. I'm not giving you the sword. He hopped with delight and did a fast, merry dance in a tight circle, as if pleased with himself beyond enduring. I half expected him to kick his heels together and break into a sprightly jig. Then he spun about to face me, applauding with gusto. Clearly himself, not me.
That's the very, very, very best part,
he gushed, eyes sparkling.
I did grant your wish. You just don't know it yet.
Not good. Which of the many half-formed desires that had sprung to my mind when I read his calling card had he chosen? And in just what convoluted manner would it be granted? History was full of genie-gone-wild tales and rabbit-paw stories. You never got what you asked for. You got a version of a wish as razor-edged as his calling card. Something that would either harm me or benefit him. Or both. I still wasn't giving him my sword. He was going to have to take it. If he could.
Oh, I can.
He leered, leaning nearer until our faces were inches apart. I went motionless, searching his eyes. Flinty eyes narrowed with cunning antiquity. Something old and deadly lurked beneath his sprightly demeanor. I'd underestimated him. He employed prancing gaiety for the same reason I allowed people to think I was younger than I am. Who are you?
A name for a name,
he cooed. A small price to know my enemy. Danny O'Malley. His eyes twinkled with mirth.
You may call me Oz. That's A-O-Z. And all capitals, by the way.
Gotcha. The A is silent, I mocked. He'd pronounced it Oz. What are you? He laid a long finger to the side of his thin nose, as if pondering what answer to offer. Finally, he said,
Those who belong here.
His face shifted and changed, the bones sharpening, skin drawing taut and far too pale, eyes narrowing, all playfulness gone. I caught a sudden reek of soil, blood and bones on his breath when he hissed.
Unlike the treacherous fairy, who think to take what is ours, not once but twice. Give me the sword, child. Undo it now.
The command affected my head, my limbs, similar to something Riordan had once done, although he'd merely forced me to eat a candy bar when I was hungry, not give away my most prized possession. And I was horrified to feel my hand rising, preparing to hand him the hilt of my sword. Apparently the spell agreed with him. We'd made a deal, and I had to honor it. I was ensnared by his power.
Stop!
An imperious voice thundered, and my hand froze, fingers locked on the hilt. Oz spun to face the intruder, hissing,
Get thee gone, fairy!
I blinked, startled. Inspector Jane had just sifted in, joining us in my bedroom, and stood a dozen paces away, on the opposite side of my bed. He wrinkled his aquiline nose and said,
By the bloody saints, what is that smell, Danny?
I shrugged, taking pains to avoid direct eye contact. Meeting the gaze of a fey prince is never a wise thing to do. First, your eyes bleed. If you hold their terrifying, inhuman gaze too long, it said your mind will hemorrhage as well. I've never tested that theory. My brain is my finest weapon. Don't ask. I hadn't seen the inspector in years. Not since he'd undergone the transformation from human to fey. I nearly hadn't recognized him. The head of the old Garda, Dublin's police force, had once been a rugged, barrel-chested Liam Neeson lookalike. No more. He'd become a towering, otherworldly being, with a stupefying gaze of opal-kissed skies, threatening thunderstorms. Hair the color of sunshine glinting off fast-running streams, and a lithe, beautifully muscled body of the light court. He smelled of fresh dew on morning petals, the crush of spring grass beneath my boots, the fertile, earthy promise of forest awakening from a long winter and a raw, to-die-for, sensual pleasure. All trace of rugged humanity was gone. Mac hadn't changed that way. Sure, her hair had lightened and lengthened, but she'd remained human like us. I scanned him intently, found nothing to define him as having been born of our race. Inspector Jane was fey with finality. I eased my sword down a notch, keeping it at the ready, trusting no one in the room but myself.
As the inspector, Jane had once taken it, leaving me in a trash-filled street, badly wounded, on